Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is Catherine Austin Fitz. Welcome to the Salieri Report. It's sometime in July. I'm someplace in America with a mysterious, elusive Dr. Joseph Farrell. And I've asked him to read our second quarter wrap-up on infrastructure. And I've asked him to watch the very delicious Warwicker trilogy. Three movies from the BBC. As a man who's spent many years deep in MI5 territory, how appropriate for you to comment on it. Anyway, so it's as you know, it's always an opportunity. It's delightful to be with Joseph. So we're going to talk through the wrap-up, but we're also going to talk, he's got a new and wonderful book. I just started to read it, and I know you're going to be wanting to get it. So it's called The Third Way, The Nazi International, the European Union, and Corporate Fascism. Given what's going on in Europe, it's very appropriate. Anyway, so I want to take some time and talk about that as well. So, Joseph, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know you're already on the next book.
Yeah, I am. thanks for having me back on.
Anyway, so infrastructure, you got a chance to read the second quarter wrap-up.
I did. There's lots of things in it that struck me, but I was looking at the map, just as I told you a few minutes ago, that you have in there the rail networks from Europe to Asia. And I was looking at the map, and two things struck me right off the top. The first was, on the existing rail system in Europe and Asia, you can travel all the way from Inverness, Scotland, to Vladivostok on one connected rail service. The other thing that struck me, I looked very carefully at the top of the map, which really leapt out at me, where they have a long Trans-Siberian rail route planned in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
And that leapt out at me because, as you know, Mr. Putin's been making a lot of talk in the last several years about development of the Arctic, development
right.
of Russian resources in that region of the world, which is virtually untapped.
Right.
So, you know, that leapt off right off the bat at me. And that means a huge, huge investment.
In infrastructure.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, to develop that region of the world, you're going to need rail services. You're going to need roads, obviously, eventually, to build the railroad. So there's huge investment going on there. And this is coming right at the time that you have the Asia Infrastructure Bank in China getting started. You've got the BRICS Bank up and running now. I think they're capitalization is what now, $100 billion or something like that is the last figure I saw. So you've got this huge project going on in Asia, and then in addition to that, I showed you that story about the Russians and China, or the Russians and the Japanese starting a joint card project with Gazprom Bank and Japanese Credit Bureau, which, of course,
which is unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it made no news over here.
Yeah. And I said to you, are they ready for the next tsunami? What?
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, it's what's interesting is one of the things that inspired me to focus, you know, each wrap-up we focus on a theme, and it's a chance for me to do the deeper research.
Right.
And one of the things that had got me interested in infrastructure is our conversations about 2.0 to 3.0.
Right.
And how if you look at what has to happen to make a big investment in space, because when you make a big investment in space, you're talking about building a suborbital platform. You're talking about building infrastructure on the moon,
yes.
on Mars.
Yes.
These are huge infrastructure investments.
Yes.
And to do that, you've got to radically improve the productivity of your manufacturing base. And that was
right.
one of the things we were talking about, is to what extent new fabrication technology, robotics, is really significantly improving the productivity. Now, to do that, you've got to have a big investment in infrastructure, railroads, which we see happening
right.
All over the world, not just, you know, computer, not just passenger traffic, but, you know, freight traffic. So those two things in combination mean big infrastructure. But then if you're going to continue the growth in the emerging markets, that's huge infrastructure. McKinsey's study, which doesn't touch space, it doesn't get into the space, you know, just that part of the overt economy is $57 trillion between 2030.
Yes.
And that's coming about at exactly the same time that the long-term bull market in bonds, which have traditionally financed infrastructure, is either plateauing or going
in the tank.
And so the very source of funding to infrastructure is plateauing or drying up at the very time you need to dramatically increase infrastructure investment. Now, one of the things McKinsey points out is if you use basically digital systems to reoptimize, that can make everything much smarter, and in fact, it can lessen the amount of physical stuff you'd have to build otherwise.
Right.
You know, which I agree on. But that, too, requires an investment in infrastructure. And so, you know, what I was looking at is this huge squeeze because the financing is going one way, the demand is going the other way. It's like a pig going through the steak. And you look at it and you think, well, wait a minute, something's have to give. And then you look at a third thing, which is why I so love the Worker Trilogy. Instead of our leadership leading in that change,
they've been
spending hundreds of billions of dollars building global prisons and rendition centers.
Yes.
So rather than lead on building the great new infrastructure, they've spent a huge amount of money sourced in the bond market, including fraudulent, on building control systems.
Right, right.
So what's that about?
Well, I watched that trilogy 5 times.
Right.
Almost nonstop, back to back. And
you're lucky the acting was great.
Yeah. Let's deal with the trilogy, and then let's deal with the rendition camps and the slave labor and all of that. The trilogy itself, I think, is a message,
right?
Very clearly,
right?
You don't get on the BBC, which is the propaganda organ of the British government, without approval, and to be doing a trilogy based around the following premise. The British Prime Minister, whose last name is Beasley, begins with a B, interestingly enough.
And he just happens to resign to go to the same job that Tony Blair
did. Yeah, and he just happens to resign and go to the same job that Tony Blair did. And the premise of the plot is very interesting. MI5 gets a hold of a file that indicates that 10 Downing Street is fully aware of all of these prison camps that the United States is building all over the world for cheap labor, rendition camps. In the second part of the trilogy, you have this group of Americans that are basically exposed and then forced to relinquish some of their investment in these things. Now, to me, this is sending huge, huge messages to the American elite that, number one, we know what you're up to. And then this is followed by another message, which you pointed out when we were talking earlier today, from The Economist, about how the American oligarchy is ossified.
Calcified,
which, again, you know, this, The Economist is the magazine of the British oligarchy, of the British elite. It's their take on the world. It's their take on geopolitics.
They followed it up with a criticism of the investment America has made in enforcement, saying that they're basically fiddling with, they're destroying, I'm going to use my words because I don't remember their exact words off the top of my head, but basically they're destroying their credibility.
Yes.
You know, what they're doing is this is lawless,
right?
You know, enforcement.
Yeah, it's lawless and it's ultimately non-productive. This is the big message that the British are sending. And this is to me, this is an earthquake. This is an earthquake. This is Britain signaling the potential end of the so-called special relationship.
Well, let me bring up some dates, because the Worker Trilogy was written by David Harris, arguably one of the great playwrights, and certainly great British playwrights existing.
Right.
So for someone of his caliber and ability to be put on this is quite extraordinary.
And to do it as a high production value.
Right.
Yeah.
And the actors they get are first. So they have Bill Nighy playing Worker, who does an incredible job. But the first one was done, I think, in 2007, 2008. And then the second two which outs the Gladstone Group, which is this group of New Jersey business guys in Turks and Caicos. Those two movies, Turks and Caicos, and then the third one, Salting the Battlefield, are put out in 2014,
right,
which is a huge amount to get accomplished in 1 year.
Right.
And look at that year. At the end of that year, they then come out with the aristocracy is calcifying.
Yeah.
And it's clearly a message.
Clearly. Absolutely. It's clearly a message. I think Britain's signaling two things here. Number one, we know what the American oligarchy has been up to. We're not in favor of it, and they're signaling the potential end of this special relationship. And number two, that means that in turn, the implication here is that Britain has gone along with the sanctions regime against Russia, but what I think it could ultimately mean, they've become a partner in the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank.
Right.
So I think what this may signal is that Britain is taking a very long-term view of the American empire. They don't like what they see. They don't like the lawlessness in the system. They don't like the immorality of the system. And that they're weighing their geopolitical and financial options to sever that special relationship and take a turn toward the East. If that happens, I mean, if Britain goes this route, as I suspect they will, they have a lot of capital in a soft form to draw on. And by that I mean they've got they can play their traditional role as the bearers of Anglo-Saxon culture, for want of a better expression. They've got the Commonwealth. They can make that turn to the East. If they do, then they're going to be throwing their lot in to a certain extent with France and Germany, making that turn eastward, and that's a huge development.
That's huge.
And this is the implication, I think, that's behind this BBC trilogy. It's the implication of that Economist article. This is all huge stuff.
But I think it's very difficult for the British to throw over that special relationship and try and, you know, sort of make their bones with the Germans and the French. If I were them, I'd rather engineer a coup d'etat here in America.
Well, this is the other, yeah, we discussed that too, and that's a real potentiality. To do something like that, they'd have to have the intelligence infrastructure to pull something like that off in this country. They did have it during the Second World War.
We notice in the Walker trilogy, part of the plot is that this group of businessmen have been stealing from the CIA.
Yes, yes.
So they've been stealing from the intelligence agencies.
Right. The message is that they would link up with disgruntled factions within the American military intelligence complex. The other group that has intelligence assets in this country and have had them for quite some time that do a lot of espionage, that's the French. They've done a lot of industrial espionage in this country. The German contacts, their intelligence, we know that in
this
country.
Well, remember, it was the French who engineered the Revolutionary War against the Brits.
Yeah, exactly.
We wouldn't have won without them.
Yeah, we wouldn't have. The other intelligence assets, of course, are all of those things going back to the post-war agreements between American intelligence and wartime German intelligence. I think that network more or less has stayed in place. I really do. I realize that's kind of a sensational thing to maintain. But a coup, yeah, if you're fed up with the way the American political elite is going, I think it's very clear that these are the messages coming out of Europe, I think that's a possibility that they might try and engineer something like that. I think you're dead on. I do.
That's what I would do if I were them. It was funny. I told the story earlier in the Salier Report. I was in the cab when I was in New Zealand and Australia, and I had a cab driver who'd come there. He lived there for more than a decade, but he was from Eastern Europe. And he said, let's face it, he said, he was talking about countries who were part of the crown.
Right.
He said, we're all stuck under the umbrella of the United States, and if they blow it, you know, we're all going down. And he said, it's very nerve-wracking. We need you guys to stop blowing it.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the message, I think, that you're getting in the Warwicker trilogy and specifically in that Economist article. Now, the message part of it, let's go back to the original question with all of these camps, these rendition camps.
Why did they do it?
Yeah, why do they need this vast labor pool?
See, I can't figure... I told you, and I'll write a book review for the website when it's done. I'm reading a book called The Company Man by a fellow who worked in the CIA General Counsel's office for 30 years, and it's fascinating. But essentially what we did as a group of people, because I believe some of my former partners were in the Gladstone Group. I think the Gladstone Group was really, and in the review on the Worker Trilogy, I explain why that's so. But why did we stop being a group of people who was building great infrastructure and instead shift our, you know, our resources into doing what we've done in space and underground, so covert.
Right.
But then building and coming out with a policy, because the CIA, in my experience, the intelligence community, in my experience, the secret societies have been torturing for decades.
Right.
You know, this is not new.
This is not new, no.
But it is new to make it official and public.
And not only that, to make it such large scale. You're looking at a large economy of scale.
A global infrastructure to torture globally.
Right. Right.
And what one of the things that was interesting is in the Company Man's book, you know, they round up a group of, after 9/11, they round up a group of people, they move them into the torture and rendition centers, and then once they've finished getting out of them whatever information they can either get out or get them to confess to, even if they're innocent.
Right.
Because I'm assuming part of the reason you want to torture people is you want them to say they did something they didn't do.
Right.
It's usually not a very effective way to get information.
Right.
So at that point, you know, years have gone by. There's nothing new that they can tell you, but yet the CIA has no place to put them and there's no exit plan.
Yeah, it's the lack of the exit plan that convinces me that we're looking at a system, really, of slave labor. Again, you know, all these camps suggest to me that while torture is the public story that they've put out in the wake of 9/11, that what you're really looking at is a system of slave labor on a large economy of scale. In other words, you're dealing with a hidden economy, and the real question then becomes, if this is the case, what's it for? What are they trying to do? And the only thing I can come up with looking at this and the size of it, I mean, this is, as you say, this is spread all over the world. The only thing I can come up with looking at this as a reason that they'd be doing this is for some reason they need that economy of scale to produce something and to do so secretly. And the analogy I'm making here is you have to go back to World War II and look at Nazi Germany and the structure of their black projects.
Right.
And when you look at the structure of their black projects, it's interesting that...
slave labor, a lot of which was underground.
A lot of which was underground. You look at the archipelago of concentration camps in Germany, and they're all located very close, if not in... these secret projects, research, development, and manufacturing facilities.
Right.
And it looks to me like what they might be doing is something very similar to that. They've got some sort of secret project that they need a basically moderately skilled labor force that they can control absolutely to produce something. And in that case, what you're looking at is, you know, you've got prisoners at Camp X producing widget Y, and then you've got prisoners at Camp Z producing widget A.
Right.
And they don't know what they're producing, but whoever's in charge of all of this system is doing it. This is the only thing I can make sense of, because, you know, slave labor is just not
economic
at all.
It's very expensive.
It's very, very expensive. So this is the only thing I can think of that would justify all this.
Well, you know, my concern about the immigration policies is we saw a very significant amount of young people brought over the border in a very fast period. And my concern was how many of those people are going underground.
Exactly. Exactly. When you're dealing with an infrastructure, when you're dealing with a hidden financial manufacturing base that's clearly, since the end of World War II, involve trillions of dollars, and that's not just accounting for the things we don't know about. This is what we do know about.
Right.
And we have to project this backward over time, over the last six decades since the end of World War II. Then this has got to be a massive hidden infrastructure. This is the only thing I can think of, that you'd need the massive amounts of funds that they do in the black budget, in the underground economy, the drug economy, which is huge.
Right.
What's all of this going for?
Right.
And why do you need all this labor? Well, it has to be some sort of massive project. And the other thing that the Warwicker trilogy brings out in kind of a subtle way is you get this undertow watching these three things. You get this undertow of urgency to what they're doing, particularly that Gladstone.
Yeah, they're very afraid.
They're very afraid, and they're
got to go fast.
It's got to go fast. Yeah.
And the Prime Minister is saying, I've seen this, it's, you know, it's real, it's urgent, it's whatever.
Right, right. And you have to wonder, what's the urgency? You know, why the big rush here? And again, what this also is speaking to is, you look at the BRICS nations, they're developing, you know, we were talking before we started recording, in your infrastructure map, the railroads that we talked about earlier in this show, the BRICS nations are developing all of this capital system, this financing system, to build all this public infrastructure.
Right.
While the United States is dumping massive amounts of money into this hidden system. So what that's suggesting is that within the British and American oligarchy, there is a group of people that know something that the BRICS nations may suspect, but they're not behaving like they know it.
They think they're building the future.
Right, exactly.
And we behave like we're leaving for Mars.
Yeah, exactly. 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 And it makes you wonder just exactly what's going on here. There are hints that some of the BRICS nations may so know something's up, because you had the Russians coming out with that very, very strange story in the last couple of weeks that, how did they put it, that the Apollo moon landings need to be investigated. Remember that one?
Yeah.
And I thought, what? And I read this article, and the article made it very clear the Russians weren't saying it didn't happen.
Right.
What they were saying is, we want to know what happened to all those moon rocks and the lost videotape that NASA claims it lost.
Uh-huh.
And I think what's really being signaled here is, we know what happened to that videotape. We may have copies of it. And do you really want us to discuss it openly? You know, this sort of thing. So there's a little bit of a hint that they may know something's up. But again, you know, the behavior of the American elite makes no sense on any conventional analysis. This is where we're going, I think. It makes no sense unless you factor into the equation what you and I have talked about so many times, that you've got a hidden system of finance that's in play here. It's very clearly being run by the West. It's being run by the West for some covert purpose, probably involving research, probably involving space. We don't know in what capacity. This is the only thing I can make sense out of.
You know, there are two places where, in the 90s, while we were doing the prisons, they did make big infrastructure investments that I wanted to mention. One was, they made a pretty significant investment in airports and upgrading
the
airports. And what was interesting is, in, you know, 98, 99, I'd be walking around and I'd say, they're building a shopping mall in this airport. How in the world are they going to get people to go to the airport to shop? It doesn't make any sense. And then when 9/11 happened, I thought, oh, that's how they're going to get people, because you doubled the time that somebody had to spend at the airport before they...
One of the biggest things that they've done infrastructure-wise at airports is in Oklahoma City. At Will Rogers Airport in Oklahoma City, there's a big facility called the Federal Transfer Center. And if you see this thing, this is a, I don't know how else to describe it other than, it looks like a facility designed to move massive amounts of people through there quickly and quietly. It's huge.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's huge. You can see it. It's huge. It's got narrow little windows like in a prison. It's right there at the airport, and you have to wonder, then, if we have this prison rendition system with people that basically don't exist anymore for the public world running all of this hidden infrastructure for whatever purpose, you have to wonder just exactly what's going on. I don't know, but the only thing I can say is it reinforces my conviction that there is something hidden going on. It's massive. It requires huge capitalization. And now, for whatever reason, in the last 10 to 15 years, it's required a huge labor pool that has to exist completely off the books. And torture, this is the real point I'm hoping that people get. Torture is the public story.
Well, it's torture. You know, what is it the Mexicans say? No, it's the Chinese say to scare the monkeys, kill the chicken.
Right.
You know, so if you have torture centers all over the world and you're grabbing people and torturing them, people say, okay, let's not rock the boat, let's not ask questions.
Right.
It's symbolic.
Yes. Yeah.
The rendition centers are clearly not prison labor, but it's a cover story.
It's a also cover story, and it can be those facilities can be used as input points,
right,
into a much vaster system. And in a certain sense, the torture could function as a vetting mechanism for, you know, who you're going to keep in those systems. The whole thing's diabolical. And for the British to come out and make that trilogy and to say the things they did in The Economist means that I think that they are getting tired of playing along with that system. If that's the case, there's big, big geopolitical and financial earthquakes coming.
Well, here's I don't know this, but my guess from watching the Turks and Caicos, the second movie in the Foraker trilogy, is the Gladstone Group and the Americans were doing two things. One is the business group, my guess, was not only stealing from, because Turks and Caicos is a crown holding.
Right, right.
They were not only stealing from the CIA, they
right.
were stealing from the crown.
A big mistake.
And
I think you're
but
right.
But they were doing something that they've been doing all over the world, which is you drop into a country, you get an elite, you pay them off, and you get them to fiddle with the local politics and do what you want. And to do that to the Brits is a big mistake, and that's what
exactly right.
they did with
that's
Tony
exactly
Blair,
right.
is what it looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you have a big Tory backlash against the Blair government. This also is very, very clear. I think a lot of this goes back, you know, to the Thatcher era and how they got rid of her in order to finesse their way, the Eurocrats in Great Britain, in order to finesse their way into the European Union. But we may be looking at the flip side of those decisions, too. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's an element here that not only did these private groups take the American intelligence community to the cleaners. At some point, they have interfered with the British crown. And if that's the case, it would have to be. Let me back up and put it this way. I think you're right, because for the BBC, which is, you know, Britain's official propaganda organ, for the BBC to be releasing that trilogy, which is not at all flattering to the American elite, that has to come from a high level in the British government. And that, to me, more than anything else, is the signal that your hypothesis here, that maybe they have raked over the royal family and the British crown, that's very plausible in my thinking.
Mm.
Yeah, that's very plausible. And yeah, you have to shake your head. You know, what would
what's the point? what's the goal? In other words, you're talking about, you know, I come from a place where we have, and excuse me if I'm racist, we have an expression called white trash.
Now we've got that expression here, too.
But why would you be, you know, the expression, if you look at how it's used where I live, it's talking about people who engage in lose-lose.
Right.
You know, lose-lose behavior, lose-lose thinking. And you're talking about something that is very lose-lose. And the funny thing about the Worker Trilogy is you almost feel like you're getting the same message as you're getting from Putin, which is, these people are morally perverted. We want nothing to do with them. It has nothing to do with price. It has nothing to do.
Right.
There is no negotiation. We're not going along with people who are that perverted.
I mull that over myself, but the answer I come to is I think you've got a certain segment of the American parasitical oligarchy that has so bought the notion. They really don't understand anything about the British oligarchy. They don't really understand anything about the British Constitution. And you know, let me just boil it down to brass tacks. In this country, we have been taught over and over and over again from elementary school all the way on up through college that the British crown, the British monarchy, is a constitutional monarchy, and that the monarch is basically a figurehead. And, you know, I've got sad news for
nobody
people.
Nobody has that much wealth as a figurehead.
Nobody that has, precisely, you know, nobody that has the wealth of the Windsors are simply figureheads. When the Prime Minister is summoned to the palace, the Prime Minister is summoned to the palace. But the other thing Americans need to remember is that the British Crown is the executive branch of the British government.
Right.
Parliament can pass all the laws it wants to. If the Queen doesn't sign it into law, it's not a law. Now, within the British system, in the last 250 years or so, the Crown has always signed these bills. But there is nothing compelling them to do so. You know, I used to entertain notions back when I was living in Great Britain that if Prince Charles were ever to succeed his mother and become king, if there was any British monarch that would be tempted not to sign some bill of Parliament that he disagreed with, it would be Prince Charles. Easily. You know, this is a very headstrong man, and whatever one thinks of him, he's not an idiot.
Right.
He exemplifies this kind of quiet power that the British monarchy really has. So, you know, I think the group in America that may have been playing around with not only ripping off the American intelligence community, but potentially even the British crown, is acting quite simply out of stupidity. That they really don't understand, because they've imbibed this propaganda from our educational system, they really don't understand what they're dealing with that group of people.
Well, here's the thing. You had, what I saw in Washington was we won the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the whistle gets blown. You pass the Uruguay Round of GATT. You do the World Trade Organization. And suddenly mm-hmm. they feel like it's theirs to take. They can
right.
run around the world. It's global sweepstakes. And they're, you know, they're just going to put everything in their shopping cart, and there's this elation of feeling we won, and now to the victor go the spoils, and now
right.
we can just grab everything, and it's, you know, it's harvest time.
Right.
You know, so we're here now, and it's harvest time.
Right.
And there's no thinking five steps down the road.
No.
It's just, you know, everybody go get yours.
Right.
And it was almost as though there was no leadership to bring it together and make sense of the whole thing.
There wasn't. Yeah, it was a big sweepstakes. Everybody was going out and filling
like
up their shopping cart.
It's almost like no one planned beyond the end of the Cold War.
They didn't. And this is rather alarming. Let's back up and say not so much that they didn't. Let's say that certain sectors in the American financial and political elite didn't. I do think that they planned for the end of the Cold War. I mean, it's very clear if you look at Chancellor Kohl in Germany, he was certainly looking at the situation and making some long-term plans. I mean, that's
right.
rather obvious. I think you could say the same thing obtained in France, and I think definitely you can say that it obtained in Great Britain. But our leadership didn't show that foresight. And this is the other thing that we're looking at, too. You're talking about infrastructure development. Well, you look at it and the way that coal handled, I talk about this in the new book, as a matter of fact, the way that coal handled the Anschluss, for want of a better word, with the former Eastern Zone. You had those horribly non-competitive state industries in East Germany that had to be, first of all, absorbed into the total German economy and then made efficient. So what he did, as you've pointed out many times, what
he tendered
for the currency on a par, you know, at par value,
right,
rather than market value, and that wiped out in the it created massive short term problems, but in the long term, you know, we're 20 plus years now down the line from German reunification, and the German economy is booming,
right,
because of that decision. Yeah, it was the right thing to do. So he kept his labor force in East Germany that could have been sucked out of the Eastern Zone into West Germany. He kept that in place by that tender offer, and that allowed him to make those old state industries efficient and absorb them into the German corporate system.
Right.
You had some considerable foresight going on in those countries. And hence, you had the investment in the soft infrastructure. You had the investment in their people. You had the investment in railroads and updating industry and retooling and things like that that you didn't have in this country. So, in a certain sense, we were totally unprepared for the collapse of the Soviet Union. And now we're paying the price. You know, we built up this huge empire, and now we've got all these camps that they're building for something, obviously. And it's very, very alarming.
There was just a court decision in the United States. The appeals court, agreed that some of the Bush administration officials could now be sued for overstepping their bounds on this issue.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's another.
That's a major switch.
Yeah, that's a major switch. There are upheavals.
So somebody in America is lining up with the Brits.
Yeah, somebody. Maybe the Brits. I think what you're seeing, possibly, is there's a faction within the finance, intelligence, military, industrial complex, whatever you wish to call it, that's looking at all of this, has to be looking at all of this. I'd be dumbfounded to find out that nobody in this country has done an analysis of the situation and what's going on. I really would. I think what you have is somebody's aligning themselves with a more sane policy and saying, look, if we keep going this way, we're going to lose Europe.
Right.
And we can't afford to lose Europe.
Right.
I mean, we just can't allow that to happen. So I don't necessarily look at it as possibly a pro-British faction, although that would certainly be in their calculation. I think they're looking at the whole situation in Europe, and they're seeing Paris and Berlin just run roughshod over Greece in this power vacuum, and they're looking at this situation and concluding it can't continue on the way it is. And they're right, it can't.
Well, you've got an economy, you've got a very powerful group which is running an economy,
yes,
with a negative return on investment.
Yes.
And it's clearly composting.
Oh, yeah.
Whole parts of the economy around the world. And it's not... The thing that's been allowing it to continue is the bond market. You've been piling up money in the bond market. And as soon as Greece and Puerto Rico ring the bell,
that's it.
It's over.
That's it.
So it's part of moving to an economy where you look at the real economy and say, look, we've got to have a positive return. I mean, that's what the Brits are saying.
Yes.
They're saying, we
yes.
have to grow. If we're going to eat it, we have to grow it.
That's right.
That's what they're saying. And that's what the Brits are saying, too.
Yes.
They're saying, you know, whatever we do, the trains have to get out on time.
Yes.
You know, it's that kind of thing. And everybody knows we've got to have a positive return. We just can't keep going around in the circle. And that keeps raising the question of why is the American leadership behaving like this? What are they afraid of? you know, what are they doing? Which gets us into all the black budget issues.
Yes.
Where's all the money going? Because it's not logical. I mean, it's perfectly plausible to say, look, these guys are just nuts.
And some of them are.
And some of them are. But that's not a compelling...
No. It isn't. And let's look at it this way. Just on conventional models of analysis, and again, you know, what I know about finance and economics and so on, you can write on the back of a postage stamp. But looking at it from a historical point of view, over the last, say, century to a century and a half, what you see increasingly happening in the United States during this time period, after the industrialization of the country, is you have an increasing reliance purely and now to the point almost exclusively on finance capital to drive the economy without the corresponding expansion of manufacture, infrastructure, real investment in real education, not Common Core and all these pseudo attempts. This is what's missing. So in other words, we're dealing with, in the United States, a finance capital-driven economy, and in Europe you're dealing with the exact opposite, particularly in Germany's case. Germany, to their credit, constructed their post-war economy so that they wouldn't lose their heavy industrial plant.
Right.
And this was...
Right, and they transitioned their workforce.
And they transitioned their workforce
right.
at the same time. So, you know, I'm not to say that Germany doesn't have problems, but the real point I'm trying to illustrate here is you've got industrial capital in Germany. You've got, in Russia, much the same thing in the form of resource capital, investment in infrastructure, investment in resources. In China, the same thing. In this country, what we see is you've got investments in derivatives and credit default swaps, and, you know, this goes nowhere.
Right.
You know, it's a vast Ponzi scheme. So there's that part of it, and it's like you say, if you look at just that, you can't make sense of it. So you have to factor in the black budget. You have to factor in the hidden finance, which I mean something different by that expression than simply black budget.
Right.
You have to factor in that somebody somewhere knows something that they're not telling publicly for whatever reason. And this is the reason they need all these camps. This is the reason they need all this labor pool that exists totally off the books that they can control absolutely and keep whatever it is that they're building a big, huge secret for whatever reason. And the only thing I can come up with in this respect is that it must have something to do with space.
So the only way I always look, I'm reminded of the story of Samson in the Bible where he's asked, you know, where does your strength come from? Because it's not intuitively obvious.
Right.
Which has always led me to the conclusion Samson wasn't a big guy.
Right.
But if you look at the Americans, all I can figure is they think they have some definitive advantage on
yeah.
weaponry, an invisible weaponry. And I put up in the web presentation for the infrastructure second quarter wrap-up the quote from my interview with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, which was, to me, such an astounding comment, because he's talking about the enormous investment that the Navy needs to keep its ports functioning.
Right.
And the Air Force, where they're near the ocean, they need to keep functioning.
Right.
Now, this is important, because without the U.S. Navy... the dollar is no longer the reserve currency.
That's right.
China's building its navy. They know what it takes. Russia knows what it takes.
Yes.
So the navy, you know, not everything's going to be done from space. The navy is your ace in the hole. You
right.
cannot afford to play games with the navy. Wilkerson's talking about how all the candidates have absolutely no interest. This
yeah.
is not how you generate fees for your friends or, you know, power or whatever. And the reality is we've run down that infrastructure for 30, 40, 50 years.
Right.
If you don't get interested in that, it's all over.
That's
there's
right.
no reserve currency, which means there's no U.S. Treasury, largesse. It's all over.
Without infrastructure, there's no empire.
So what is it that would have a group of people so confident that they didn't need to attend to that? Now, the other thing I forgot to tell you, when we're talking about the two things they did in infrastructure, one was airports, the other was coliseums.
Yes.
So stadiums.
Yes.
So it was bread and circus.
Bread and circus.
Bread and circus. So in addition to prisons, we have bread and circus.
Well, it didn't get Marie Antoinette very far, and it didn't get Rome very far. It's not going to get us very far. We have to have. Number one, we have to have a rail service in this country much better than we do now. Our trains move at snail's pace compared to what Europe or Japan or China or Russia can move goods and services by rail. It's just not the rail service you would expect a great power to have, number one. So that needs to be done. The interstate highway system, we were talking before we started recording about the tremendous infrastructure that the interstate highway system represents and the vast economic boom that occurred because of not only its building, but simply because once the system was finished, goods and services could move quickly and efficiently around the country. Well, the system, the interstate system, is now dilapidated in most parts of the country. So, you know, that needs to be refurbished. Our bridges, you know, some of our bridges, I showed you that bridge earlier today when we were traveling, and our bridges are in awful shape in many parts of the country. Again, this needs to be taken care of. So...
It's funny, I told you when I, you know, I came from a world, including on Wall Street, where infrastructure was the source of power. So it was
exactly.
a great discussion. You know, it was full of electricity, infrastructure.
Right.
And yet when I started to talk publicly and...
People yawn.
Yeah, what I discovered, and it was so funny because I had this long sort of frustrating relationship for many years with the Coast to Coast group because nobody wanted to talk about infrastructure or bridges or roads or communities or, you know, all the things that to me were the source of real power. And finally I came to understand, okay, you know, they're right that so much of this game is coming from space and I need to deal with that.
Yeah.
But I still couldn't get them interested in infrastructure because for them there was no power. And what's interesting about what the BRICS have done, you know, the BRICS have finally just said, fine, we get it, the World Bank and the IMF is not going to play, we're on our own, fine, we're going to do it. And now they're into, you know, let's build the future, and they're excited about it.
Right.
If you look at all the different regional cooperation groups coming together across the Silk Road, you know, it's railroad, it's pipelines, it's roads, it's everything.
Right.
And you can tell they're having fun. You know,
right.
it's you look at the pictures of their meetings, they're having fun. It's great.
They're
it's
smiling.
Great. It's great to be building, and they're like, okay, we don't know how to cooperate and do these big financial mechanisms and manage this kind of risk, but we're going to have to, we'll figure it out.
Right.
Because we're on our own, we have to do it. And you kind of see the Americans going, well, wait a minute, you know, how do we step on this and get them going through our mechanisms? But our mechanisms aren't set up to handle, you know, we walked away from that a long time ago and left it to kind of slowly go no place. So they have no choice. But as you can see last week, China paid a very big price
in
the game of economic warfare. And if you look at the market today, it's clearly saying, okay, the U.S. leadership won that one.
But again, I think going back to the model here of finance capitalism versus industrial and entrepreneurial capitalism, ultimately, finance capitalism can never win.
Right. Absolutely.
And sooner or later, the pressure of forces are going to... If the American leadership is sane, and the question's out on that, if the American leadership is sane, it's going to have to change its game and change it drastically. Otherwise, we're going to be left in the dust. You cannot.
Well,
let's put it this way.
We're being left in the dust.
We're being left in the dust.
At the worst part last week, you saw the Chinese market down 15%. Bonds hardly bumped.
Right.
And the dollar hardly bumped.
Right.
And so, you know, and part of that is we're moving one way or another. You know, the bond game is over. So.
Right.
So the question is, the real economy matters, and there's a whole bunch of people who just decided that they're more interested in the real economy than playing along with this silly game.
Well, let's look at it this way. Let's look at the infrastructure problem this way in relationship to the Navy. You have data that's indicating that water levels are rising in ports on the Atlantic and Pacific that are currently ports are faced with a future where the facilities themselves are either going to have to be diked like the Dutch do, which means an investment in infrastructure so that you can keep your ports so that you can have your Navy. And the other thing, you know, if you're going to maintain this global naval presence and have bases all over the world, plus home bases in the United States, you're going to have an infrastructure in this country that can move the goods that you need to get to your ships, to supply your ships, to keep your supply ships supplying the ships, and we don't have enough of it.
Right.
So, you know, the other thing, you know, if you're thinking just purely in military terms alone, you have to have this infrastructure. Let's go back to the interstate highways. What's the official name of the interstate highways? The National Defense Highway System.
Right.
You know, this was clearly conceived not just as an economic tool, but as a tool of the expression of American economic and military power to move goods and services around the country quickly and efficiently. So, yeah, you know, and the same thing. You know, we took the cue from Hitler and his autobahns, you know, in Germany during the interwar period. So, clearly, you can't have and sustain a global military power without having the infrastructure to do it. So if we're going to maintain that, we have to start investing in this country again and in the infrastructure of the country. No way, no two ways about this.
So if you look at, McKinsey did a study that basically said, can we do this $57 trillion? And what they said is, yeah, if we radically increase productivity now.
Right.
Without going through all the different steps involved, and I agree you can, what you need is, first of all, you need a much more transparent system.
Yes.
And you need a much more participatory system, and you need much more collaboration. And when you get down into the numbers and how it all translates out, what you're talking about is a radically different
yes.
leadership.
Yes.
You cannot have leadership which is 100% lawyers.
No, you can't.
It's not working.
It's not. You can't have leadership that's 100% lawyers or bankers or... what's the word I'm looking for?
Paper shufflers.
Paper shufflers, right. You can't do it. You have to bring in the engineers. You have to bring in the entrepreneurs. You can't be reliant on big cartel capitalism.
So either. I thought we'd have, you know, when I watched all the money being stolen, I thought, okay, well, you have the mobsters steal the money. But then when it's over, you switch the leadership.
Yeah.
And you put in the people that do the next phase, whatever
right.
that is. You know,
because
right. the way you engineer a financial coup d'etat and who you use is totally different than what you use for phase two.
Right.
And so the question is, what's phase two and who's the leader? But I don't see a turn happening.
I don't either.
It's just
it's
children
all,
and wives of phase one.
It's all going into shiny upgrades of the old model. You know, we've got Google and quantum computing and data management and software and surveillance. You know, it's all the same old stuff. And we don't see any investment in hard infrastructure. And for that matter, in soft infrastructure. And by that, I mean an investment in the human capital that's going to be necessary to preserve the lifestyle we're accustomed to. And it's not going to come out of Common Core. I'm sorry, it's, you know, that whole thing is a sham.
Well, Common Core, to me, Obamacare and Common Core is
the same thing.
A way of standardizing all education so you can re-engineer it to the digital system so you can centrally control it.
Exactly.
And take over the last two parts if the local economy haven't taken over.
Right, exactly.
But what you're going to do is you're basically going to take 80% of the kids, doom them to failure and permanent dumb down.
Right,
and
you can't compete.
And then the other 20% are not going to be well educated. So what's
well, we will not be able. Trust me, we will not be able to compete with China or India or Russia.
But that's the plan.
That's the plan, apparently. So you know, I don't. I'm with you. I don't see any real leadership in this country. And like you said earlier, there's.
Well, to me,
the possibility of a real coup.
Yeah, if you look at Common Core and Obamacare, it's very interesting because last week we had a lot of people saying the Chinese market was bubbled. Now, the Chinese market has run up a tremendous amount in the other year, but if you look at where it started at a very low PE, and it still hasn't reached the PE of the United States.
Right.
So, but the big sector that's really been the strength in the U.S. market has been healthcare and the reengineering of the healthcare industry. And every time the Supreme Court rules, of course, it goes up a lot. So a lot of this is really the government subsidy and government support creating a monopoly. And that's what's driving the market up. And as you know, I talked about Carl Denninger's piece last week where he basically said he took a surgical center in the heartland and then a testing center in Arizona, which passed a law that says now I don't have to go through a doctor to get a test. I can just walk into a testing center and get a test myself.
Right.
What he was saying is the prices are 20% of the Medicare price.
Exactly.
And if you look at the 20% on deductible on Medicare, he said, you know, that's it. Now, if you talk about a bubble,
that's a healthcare bubble.
That's
huge.
The biggest bubble on the planet.
Yep.
That is the biggest bubble in the stock market on the planet. And it's not a real economy. It's a fake economy.
Exactly.
It's a complete fake economy. And we've been putting, as a nation, imagine if we'd taken all the time and energy we put into Obamacare and Common Core over the last 3 years and instead put that into designing great infrastructure that made us economically competitive.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, or fix the Navy's problem or, you know, whatever you want. You know, but it's all massive investment in paper shuffling.
Yep.
Backed up with government money coming from the bond market. How's that supposed to work?
It won't. It won't.
And it's going to wipe out the local economies. It will wipe them. It's wiping them out now.
It's wiping them out now, and it'll get worse. You know, again, markets ultimately correct themselves no matter how much central control that you try and put on. I mean, this is just economic reality. And the real problem is are we going to have the leadership? And I go back to something I used to say on another show with a friend passed away recently. And that is that the American elite, the American financial power elite, began in the late 19th century and early 20th centuries through their networks of foundations and so on and so forth to surround themselves with people that had more or less the same ideology. So in other words, when you surround yourselves with people that think like you do, and you're confronted with a new circumstance that doesn't conform to your ideology, you can't think outside the box. So in other words, we're going back to that Economist article and the fact that the American leadership is now calcified because it's no longer able to entertain any ideas that conflict with its central dogmas. And this is a very bad situation, because they're not responding to reality. The Supreme Court's not responding to reality. The markets really aren't responding to reality, particularly in healthcare, like you've pointed out. So I don't know what to make of all of this. I think we're ripe for something like what you've said earlier, a coup. And
here's the thing,
happens,
if you look at the Crown holdings, because it's
oh
very
boy, they're huge in this country.
When you sit and you do, when I was in Australia, I was looking, I was going through the New Zealand budget when I was in New Zealand, and then I got back to Australia and went, basically, if you look at the Crown position, it's the equity.
Yes.
It's the, what I call the Z piece.
Yes.
But it takes all the risk.
Yeah.
And if you look at the extent to which all the Crown holdings globally are dependent on the U.S. military operation.
Yes.
You know, they can't afford for the U.S. to mess up. And it's not so easy to just walk off and say, oh, Germany and France, you know, include
us in
and be nice and pick up the slack. You know, that's
not going to happen.
You know, the Germans will extract and the French will extract a huge price.
Yeah.
So the question is, you can't afford for your Navy to just run around and behave like this.
No.
And you can't afford for your Navy to be flooded.
And you can't afford for your leadership to behave like this.
Right. It's too expensive.
Yeah.
And you're the Z piece,
yeah.
At least on all the Crown holdings, which, in terms of landmass, you add them all up, it's bigger than the United States.
Oh, it's huge.
Right. So you've got Australia, you've got New Zealand, you've got Canada, you've got the UK, you've got all the land they have here. that's a lot of risk.
Yes.
You know, it's like the insurance company. So if you're responsible for that, you need adults running things.
Yeah, you do.
You've got to have adults. You can't afford this anymore.
No, you can't. You can't. There's going to be, let's put it this way, it doesn't change in a genuine way in this next presidential cycle. I fully expect that by the one after that, something is going to happen to force a change. I really do. Because you look at the current presidential cycle, no one on either side of the political aisle, no one's talking about the infrastructure in this country. Obama, when he ran the first time,
He tried.
And we saw where that got him. It went nowhere. And he tried because I think he was, whoever was advising him, I suspect it's coming out of the old JFK circle, Ted Sorensen and people like that, that were advisors in his first campaign. But that just went nowhere. And it can't continue on like this. And you look at the current bevy of candidates on both sides of the aisles, and there's not a fresh idea among the lot. Right. There really isn't. So it's got to change. Either this election cycle, some big surprise is going to come out of the wings that we're not expecting, or it's going to change in the next one, because it can't go on this way. The Brits have signaled this. The Brits, I think, have spoken for not only the Great Britain, but for the British Commonwealth, which, you know, is a substantial portion of the global economy. They've spoken for the British Commonwealth. They've spoken for the British culture. And by that, I mean in the broad sense, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. And to a certain extent, I think they may be speaking for Europe as well. In spite of the fact there's no love lost between London and Paris and Berlin, I think to a certain extent they're speaking for the Europeans as well in this regard. So it's got to change.
Well, it's funny because if you look at the top investors, the ones who are responsible for the most money, they're saying the same thing that the people are sitting and managing money in the offshore havens have to be thinking, which is unless you significantly improve the investment in the real economy, nobody's going to make any money.
That's right.
Because you've run your thing down, or you've taken it as far as it can go. You've got to get yields in the real economy. You've got to invest to get those yields.
Yep.
And now we're talking about really killing the goose that laid the golden egg.
I don't know if you're familiar with Webster Tarpley, but he's a fellow I listen to a great deal because he's kind of he's an interesting fellow from the standpoint of his historical and economic analysis. He talks constantly about the need for a new kind of New Deal. In other words, he's a classic Roosevelt New
right.
Deal
Well,
Democrat.
They all believe in infrastructure.
Yeah, and they do.
They do.
Quite definitely.
Yeah.
They do. And I think in this respect that he's absolutely right. You know, I'm certainly not in favor of government programs like that, but I do think if you got this whole system, this finance capital mercantilist government system out of the way and freed up that capital to start making the investments in localities, in local infrastructures like you've been advocating for so long, things would turn around, and probably very quickly.
Right.
It's clearing out this whole parasitical apparatus that's going to be
right.
the problem, and that's going to require some major. Let's put it this way: it's going to require major assistance.
You have to let capital flow without the violence,
right?
And so you're going to have to let local optimization happen, and that's going to cut into the profits that have been protected by the violence.
That's right.
So that's
Well, this is why I say it's going to require some major external help.
Right.
And this is why I think your model of a potential coup.
Right, and it's not going to look like
a. It's
coup.
Not going to look. No, exactly. It's not going to look like a junta.
It's going to look like the old guys being shifted out and
yes.
the new guys being brought up, but it's going to be. You know, the new guys are going to have a different profile.
Yeah, it's going to come in the form of. international liaison officers, you know, things like, you know, we can laugh, but this is the way it's going to come. Well, this is Sir Winfred so-and-so from Great Britain, and here he's here to advise us on such and such.
We're suddenly going to find our boards populated by a lot more Brits and Dutch.
We're going to, British, yeah, you've said it right there. We're going to see a lot of British, we're going to see a lot of Dutch, we're going to see some Italians from the Po Valley, where, you know, they're going to be arriving in droves. So... Which is a good thing, you know. I really do think in a way it's a good thing, not just financially and economically, but culturally, because it's going to get Americans out of their blinkers on, you know, view of the world and
right.
culture.
Okay, so there are a few this and that's I want to talk about. The OPM hack.
Oh boy.
We're changing the topic from infrastructure. Well, not really.
Not really.
You know, one of the big infrastructure questions that I couldn't figure out while I was looking at this is I get a lot of magazines because I like to scan what's going on. And you have just constant propaganda saying, you know, the solution to all things is we're going to put everything on the internet and our cars are going to be smart, our house is going to be smart. In the meantime, I'm spending half of my day dealing with software systems
that don't work.
Systems that don't work, you know, hacking, you know, all the digital systems, they do not work. I feel like I live in a third world country.
Yes.
It wastes enormous amounts of my time and money and my
yep.
team's time and money.
Yep.
You know, I go abroad. Everything works. Not a problem. You come
yep.
back here
and
it's just
works.
Like fight. It's like trying to run in saltwater taffy using our systems. And so, but I read all these magazines. Oh, cars are going to be on the internet. And everything's going to work. And I thought, you know, it's like two tsunamis coming at each other at
yes.
60 miles. You know, at high speed, boom. You know, talk about an infrastructure that doesn't work, and the whole financial system depends on it.
Yes.
I mean, how's this supposed to work? Everything's...
The OPM hack, let's look at some events that I think are very curious that are directly infrastructure related. And the OPM hack, the Office of Personnel Management, is one. Then we had the recent New York Stock Exchange thing, the glitch.
I was assuming they just were trying to shut down the program trading.
I thought about that.
Because remember, what that meant was the market didn't stop, but all the trades had to go through
NASDAQ and elsewhere. And the dark pools, right.
So you're taking an enormous amount of the trading and you're routing it out of the stock exchange and into the dark pools
right.
where it is much easier for you to control.
Yeah.
So it's not clear to me that that was a, you know.
Well, I'm looking at that. I'm kind of putting it in a total context. I'm looking at the NYSE hack. I'm looking at the OPM hack. I'm looking at United Airlines being hacked on the same
right,
day.
On the same day.
And for what, 2.5 hours? Their whole system goes down.
Did you see what the Drudge headline was?
No.
Glitches galore.
Well, he's right.
He's right.
And then you had those curious incidents out in the San Francisco Bay Area of all the internet cables being physically severed.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. This is a huge story that, you know, 11, I think it was 11 or 13, I forget which of the exact number is, incidents like this in the last few months of internet cables actually being physically severed in the whole Bay Area.
Wow.
Now... I'm looking at all of this, and I'm thinking somebody's sending us some messages. Somebody has to be sending us some messages. And the message is, quite bluntly, your systems are not safe, and your systems are not secure. Why should we do business with you?
Right.
And when you and I were talking, the other interesting thing, you mentioned the old... Promise software, the InSlaw software, that you and I both think is behind a lot of this stuff and all of its updates. The interesting thing is if you go back to, and we're going back to Britain here, the interesting thing is if you go back and examine the Promise software and where it ended up, well, it ended up in the RCMP in Canada, the Mounted Police. It ended up in Egypt. It ended up in Iraq. Some of it was even deliberately leaked by the Reagan administration to the Soviet Union, where it blew up a pipeline. it was leaked, I believe, to Australia, Israel, but not Great Britain.
Right.
And I think this is so immensely important. What the message is, if these events were coordinated, and everything in my intuition tells me that those events were coordinated, all of them, somebody is sending a message. The message is, first of all, your systems are not secure. Number two, if you can play covert ops in our backyard, we can play covert ops in your backyard.
Right.
And when you look particularly at the San Francisco internet problems, you know, that area has been a hub of foreign espionage activity. The Russians have been there in force. The Chinese, obviously. The French, you know, this is right. The other big thing that we have to remember. The French are huge industrial espionage people. So I'm looking at all this, and again, I think somebody's sending some very not too subtle messages. You guys need to clean up your game, and you need to clean it up fast, because otherwise we're out.
Well, I didn't understand. I had always thought that the personnel files for the intelligence agencies were the intelligence agencies. It never occurred to me that they were over at OPM.
Yeah.
And I had no idea how sensitive some of the OPM files were.
Oh, yeah.
And this is very scary because, you know, I think it's hard for somebody just picking up a newspaper and reading it to understand how much power it gives whoever hacked it. Now, it's not clear to me we know who hacked it.
Let's put it this way. You and I both know a mutual acquaintance of mine who was in intelligence, and when he found out that all of those personnel files were being run by OPM, he pitched a fit.
Right.
Because this was not the case when he was, you know, active in that community. And what it's telling me, this OPM hack, I don't think this is coming from within this country. I really don't. I think that was somebody else.
Right.
And the only people with the sophistication that could pull that off would be either the Russians, the Chinese, maybe even the Japanese.
Could pull it off.
The Brits absolutely could pull it off, yeah. So, and let's not forget, Ms. Merkel is pretty pissed off about the NSA spying on her cell phone. So, you know, anybody's the guess here, but I don't think it's coming from inside this country.
But if you wanted to shift the U.S. leadership, getting those files would be invaluable.
Absolutely. Bingo. Ding, ding, ding. That's where I was going. That's where I was going. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because you would need...
You'd need a vast database of people that you could profile.
Right.
That exist within the American intelligence community, that exist within the various agencies and departments of the federal government.
Right.
You would need a file on federal state liaisons.
Right.
You'd need a file on potentially state governments that are important, Texas, California, New York. You'd need all of the connections with the lobby groups.
Right.
And OPM is the perfect place
to get a lot of
suction.
That.
Yeah, right. to get your database up and going. Absolutely.
Right.
And the fact that, I think this is the other thing that makes your scenario plausible, the fact that it occurs when it does, as we're gearing up for yet another, you know, from all appearances so far, meaningless presidential cycle, you know, pick candidate A or candidate A.1, you know, the fact that it occurs in that time frame makes me awful suspicious. Somebody's preparing, and this is the other reason I think this is coming from outside the USA. Absolutely. And if it's not coming from outside the USA, let's look at it differently. If it's not coming from outside the USA, then it's going to be coming from probably a corporate interest in the USA that's going to pass the information along to their friends overseas. So we end up with the same thing.
Well, you could have a couple of options. So you could have the Russian and China playing, you know, offensive defense.
Right.
Okay. Because they're doing it to us. You know, we've been doing it to them. They're doing it for us. And the Chinese know the value of that intelligence.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay, so yes, it could be them. But it could be a corporate interest.
Sure.
So it could be the corporation saying, look, we don't like the way you're outsourcing this and that, you know. So,
right.
I mean, we've seen the impact of Snowden was that now Google and AT&T have the access, but NSA doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay? So that was a corporate takeover of the surveillance systems.
Right.
Okay. Now, if you look, Snowden worked for Booz Allen. Booz Allen is a major contractor at OPM.
Right.
So for all we know, this is Snowden, too.
It could be.
Okay. So that's another possibility. Another possibility is, you know, it's our allies who decided that they're going to shake up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for all we know, the defense contractors could be working with them.
Yeah. With Japan, France, United Kingdom, Germany, Italy, you've got countries right there that would have the computer hacking expertise to pull off something like that, particularly with the Brits. I mean, the capabilities of GCHQ are very similar to the NSA. So
right.
we may be looking, as you say there, I think, at providing the database necessary to put your quote-unquote coup network, your coup infrastructure into place. Absolutely.
Right.
And take out this corrupt mafia that's been running things for so long.
Part of the problem you have if you're at the G7 allies and you're scared about where it's going is if the more the U.S. dependence or system depends on force, the more force they're going to have to use.
Right.
So what you're trying to avoid is
using force.
War.
Yes. Yes.
Whatever the nuclear war looks like, whether it's 20 tsunamis or 50 earthquakes. Or
right. Yeah, you're trying to head off the past because historically, and I've said this before, historically the United States right now is in exactly the same position that Venice was at the beginning of the 1500s. Where Venice had used its finance capital clout and its ability to raise military power quickly and then apply it very sharply and suddenly. Venice had reached the stage by that point in its history that it had literally, and I'm going to use the bad expression here, pissed off just about everybody in Europe. And they finally said, enough is enough, we're taking it out. The only thing that saved Venice was some pretty underhanded diplomacy. But for a moment, all of Europe was aligned against them. And there was no way, had that coalition stuck together, there was no way that they could have survived it. We are in the same position now. We have so extended this unipolar principle of geopolitical action in the world. We have driven ourselves into this morass in the Ukraine. We are poking sticks in the cage of the Russian bear, and the Russian bear is not biting. We have alienated most of Europe, and in the process, we're alienating Japan. There's no other way I can read Shinzo Abe and his government rearming Japan other than as a long-term realization we cannot rely on this group. We financed them enough. We cannot rely on this group anymore. And we're going to play along like we're rearming to help America combat the Chinese and counterbalance. You know, that's not what's going on. Not for a moment. We've alienated every ally. And like you say, they can either have to deal with us with force or if they can engineer a change of regime and take it out of this parasitical oligarchy's hands and restore some sanity, that's what they would do.
Okay, so what are we going to do if the OPM hack was done by the neocons? You know who's been... The group that was most slowing the neocons down was the long-term civil service bureaucracy.
Right. Right.
It was the American version of the Johnny Walkers who were slowing them down.
Right. If that's the case, let's look at it this way. If that scenario is true, and I think there's a good possibility that it is, than the intelligence services of the European powers, including Russia, and the intelligence services of India and Japan and China, are going to be looking at that incident. They're going to know immediately if that's the case, and they're going to respond in their governments in a very similar way as if one of them or all of them were behind the hack themselves. In other words, they are going to try and get a hold of that information, and in the meantime, they are going to try and prevent the use of that information by the neocons against that civil service bureaucracy. So in other words, the only thing that changes in that scenario, in my opinion, is it simply complicates their response, but it doesn't change their response. Right. So ultimately, they're going to be gathering their own databases. They're going to try and do similar hacks and get their people lined up. So I don't see that it changes anything. It just complicates the procedure that they've got to go through. And, you know, going back to work, or MI5 and MI6 love a good challenge.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is if you look at how insecure most systems are globally, yeah. You almost wonder if nature isn't forcing transparency on us, whether we do, you know, we like it or not. Because secrecy is starting to break down.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is.
Okay, now speaking of which, I want to turn and talk about your book.
Okay.
Okay, new book, The Third Way. Mm-hmm. Tell us about why you decided to write this book.
I had intended, when I wrote the Nazi International, some of the information in this book I had actually uncovered 7 years ago when I was writing Nazi International. And I debated at the time whether or not to include the information that's in this book in that book. And I decided no, because for one thing, it would be too overwhelming. And number two, the context of this book is the European Union and the presence within it of that old German trust cartel Nazi Party nexus.
Right.
And when you read the details, you'll literally be gobsmacked.
I think of it as the Nazi stream.
I go into a great deal of analysis of the long-term, consistent German foreign policy, going back to the Kaiser, of backing radical Islamicist groups, literally weaponizing Islam for use against the British Empire and America, number one. This has been a consistent feature of German foreign policy down to our day. Everybody thinks of Russia backing Iran. What people don't realize is the heavy German investment in Iran and the heavy transfer of technology from Germany to Iran. You've got all of this in play. The other thing that I talk about a great deal in the book is the way the German corporate power structure is actually structured. Because when you look at that country and the corporations that dominate it, you're dealing with the same old group of gigantic companies. You know, you've got ThyssenKrupp, you've got Hoechst, you've got BASF, you've got essentially the IG Farben cartel split back into its original component companies, but those original component companies are still there, and they're still extraordinarily powerful.
Right.
These companies dominate the German economy, and therefore they dominate the German state. But what most people don't realize is that the way that the European Union's structure right now is structured is all coming out of wartime plans that were being drawn up by IG Farben and by the Nazi Party as early as 1942, right down to the detailed exchange rate mechanism that was ultimately put in place in the 1970s with Schmidt and Valérie Destan in France, the details are astonishing. I mean, you can't look at it and say, oh, my God, you know. And that's the reason I was very quiet and tight-lipped about this book until it was actually physically out, because I didn't want people to think that I was making all this up and not have the information in their hand that they can look at and see and see it. And right. The interesting thing in the book is I point out that two Brits, Christopher Story, whom you know, was, you know, a typical middle-class British man that was looking at all of this and thinking, my God, they're back, you know, and with a vengeance. And, you know, he meant to do something about it. But the other Brit that I talk about in the book is a fellow by the name of Bernard Connolly. And Connolly was actually in the European bureaucracy closely associated with running the exchange rate mechanism back when that was in place prior to the euro. And he was looking at all of this, and he comes right out and tells you in the book that, you know, this is all coming out of IG Farben and Nazi party plans, and everybody's complaining about Germany running everything. Well, it's no wonder, because that's what they had planned. So in other words, you look at all of this, and World War II is this kind of a hiccup in what their plans were. So the book is interesting because it gives you, I think, a frightening glimpse as to what's going on behind the scenes geopolitically in Europe right now, with the Ukraine, with Greece. It's truly frightening, because I begin the book with a review of a document that's not very well known at all, called the Madrid Circular.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's creepy.
Yeah.
And the more you read it, you're thinking, I'm reading New York Times headlines from 2015. But this document was actually ostensibly dated 1950, and it's first published by a German-American who's trying to raise the alarms about what's going on in 1953. So, in other words, you can go back at least to 1953 and read this thing, and it's a blueprint of what's happening now. And this is what's really scary. It talks about the Ukraine. It talks about Britain. You know, the whole. It talks about dollar diplomacy and why that's ultimately not going to work. And it's just, you know, it's a breathtaking thing. The other thing that I hint at the very end of the book is that you look at American post-war politics, and you see something very odd going on that nobody talks about in breadth. You've got the Reese Committee in the House of Representatives doing this examination of the power of foundations.
Right. Then
of course you've got the whole McCarthy thing with the communists that had been brought in and communist sympathizers under Roosevelt. Then you've got the McClellan Committee investigating the mafia. So you've got all of these post-war attempts that are looking at the structure of American politics and power, and they're realizing that there's this huge festering pustule of racketeering and influence going on with all these groups. But there's another factor in play here. You have all of these dirty deals that were made with the Nazis. And if you read what's going on, you sense that all of these different committees are getting very close to something, and Truman and Eisenhower are running around
trying to stamp
it out.
Right.
And prevent it from coming out. And I think the urgency here, Truman was aware of all of this because, you know, he set up his loyalty review boards and so on and so forth. But I think Truman, in particular, reacts so vehemently and forcefully, you know, after the conviction of Alger Hiss, you see the Truman administration just absolutely shut down any further cooperation with Congress. And I think what's going on, I'll be very blunt here, and I don't say this in the book, but I'll say it here. I think Truman is reacting because, number one, he set up that hidden system of finance in 1947. And when you've got McCarthy and McClellan and the Reese Committee and
they're
the House, they're getting too close to this.
They're getting too close.
Yeah. So we got to shut all of this down. And we've got to shut it down fast. And, you know, he's not successful in McCarthy's case. This carries over into Eisenhower's administration. But ultimately, that, of course, the whole Army McCarthy thing is, I think, engineered to shut that down, because they're protecting a system of finance that by now is up and running, and we can't have all of these committees going around and trying to expose this thing.
Right.
So there's this whole post-war history of all of these congressional committees that are looking at all of this. I don't think anybody has ever adequately tried to write a history of that period. And we have to remember, you know, this is the period of history that makes the political careers of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Hubert Humphrey, Edward Dirksen, Carl Munch, Barry Goldwater. These are all people that have their political outlook and careers begin in this period. This is a crucially important period for us and for the things that you and I have talked about so many times on your show. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, no one has attempted to write a history of what's really going on here.
Well, it's amazing, because if you look at the last 100 years, mm-hmm. every time somebody tries to open the door and look at Mr. Global,
it gets slammed in their face.
There's a war, or there's a crisis, or there's a 9/11.
The interesting thing to me is, being from South Dakota, I grew up when Senator Carl Munch was still a sitting senator. I remember him very, very well as a boy. And, of course, Munch was famous for chairing the Army McCarthy hearings. He was one of the few senators that voted not to censure him. And he grew up in South Dakota in a very different understanding of that whole era. Because I could go to the Sioux Falls Public Library and pull off William F. Buckley's defense of McCarthy and what was really going on. I could go and pull off all of these books that Munch made sure got into all of these public libraries. So I never had quite the take that most people had about that whole episode. But what's interesting to me is, if you look at not just McCarthy, but if you look at Nixon, you look at the House on America's Activities Committee, you look at McClellan, and all of these people, what really is coming out of this, and I was dumbfounded when I read this, Catherine, one of the people that had, and this will ping your radar big time, one of the people that had come under not only McCarthy's scrutiny, but Truman's loyalty board, was Dr. Edward Condon. Hang on. And Condon was considered such a security risk during World War II that General Groves, in charge of the Manhattan Project, trusted him less than he trusted Robert Oppenheimer, you know, who they overlooked for his for his communist sympathies. And I thought, when I read that, I thought, you're kidding me, because you know who Edward Condon is? He was the fellow in the 1960s that the U.S. Air Force chaired or tapped to chair the UFO whitewash.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh, ding, ding, ding. I thought, okay, we've got something there. And then who else, who are the other people that are not only under the spotlight of McCarthy, but they're under the spotlight of the House on American Activities Committee? Well, you've got people like Harry Dexter White. You've got people like Owen Lattimore. And Lattimore is the interesting one here, I think. Because what's Lattimore involved with? Well, Lattimore is involved with Henry Morgenthau going over to Chiang Kai-shek. And it's Lattimore and Morgenthau that refused to return Chiang Kai-shek's gold. Now where are we at? Well, we're at hidden system of finance. We're at Chinese gold, you know, bearer bonds with Morgenthau's name on it. So, you know, they're getting close to something, I think. All of these little indicators are getting close to something. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with mafia, with communists, or anything like this. The real thing that's at the heart of this, squatting in the middle of all of these committees, is there's this huge financial structure that they're trying to protect. And Reese is looking at one part of it, and McClellan, you know, he's looking at the mafia, and he's looking at another part of it. And you've got Nixon, and this whole structure, I think, is what's really
at work. You know, it's interesting what you're saying, because you've heard me say before that I think that the American history is a history of replenishing the slush funds.
Yes, exactly.
But one of the things I'm wondering about, because the Crown is the Z piece,
right,
on the Anglo-American alliance, certainly a big part of the over, I wonder if there's a fundamental non-alignment between the needs to manage risk in that Z piece and the hidden system of finance, and it's just reached a point
where you can't.
It's reached
right,
a
bingo.
Boiling point, and one's got to come out on top,
right?
And
the way, yeah, I think that's a big, huge thing. Yes,
if that's going on inside the Anglo-American alliance, then you're talking about a big, big governance issue. That's a big.
Oh yeah, I think Catherine.
It either gets worked out or you destroy the Anglo-American alliance.
I think all of the history of that period and all of what we've been talking about now. What you've just said is exactly true, and here's why.
Well, here's the thing. The city is the most powerful. You know, the city's got more billionaires than America.
Oh, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
How can the city not be on top? I mean, the city runs the biggest network of tax havens in the world.
Let's look at it this way. In order to pull that hidden system of finance off, it's just like I said at the Secret Space Conference. In order to pull this off, they have to have the participation of certain prime banks in the West. So in other words, let's look now at the fact that you have all of these bankers connected with the very prime banks that emerge in connection with this hidden system of finance or these bearer bond scandals or whatever. You've got J.P. Morgan, you've got Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, you've got Union Bank of Switzerland,
right.
You've got Deutsche Bank. So, in other words, the participants in the system, the British bankers, the German bankers, the Canadian bankers, the Chinese bankers, they know this system exists, or at least some of them do. And like you say, the problems...
And they're dropping like flies.
And they're dropping like flies. So, in other words, the governance issue is coming to the fore. The system has to be rolled up. And in part, I think that's what happens with 9/11. But... at that earlier stage, in the post-war stage, from, say, 1945 up to the death of Kennedy, that period, I think, is dominated. And I'll just come right out and say it, that the hidden thing dominating all of these scandals that are going on that lead up to the assassination of President Kennedy involves protecting that structure and maintaining it long enough that it gets up and running. So in other words, we're looking at the beginning of one thing in the post-war period with all of these committees and not anybody really ever being able to figure out what all the hullabaloo was about. And then now we come down to the present and we're looking at that system being unraveled. So they're either having to unravel the system and roll it up and turn it into something else, which I think there parts of them are trying to do, and the other part of it, they're trying to move, like you've suggested many times, they're trying to move all of the assets that they can into that system, all the liabilities into the public system that they
right.
can. So, and what's happening as a result of that, I think, is you see Japan, you see with the BRICS, you see Germany especially, you see these countries realizing we cannot sustain this system anymore because ultimately if we do, we're going to lose any last shred of our sovereignty. So this is a, like you've pointed out, this is a huge governance issue. The
right.
things are coming out right now. So I think, you know, this is a hugely, for me it was a difficult book not to talk about. I said nothing, literally nothing about this book. Usually I give little hints, but this is a hugely, I think, important book. And I had a couple people email me after they got their copies and started reading it. And one person finished chapter one, and he says, "Holy cow, this is like reading the whole current global situation, and this is being said in 1953.
Right.
In a Nazi document.
Right.
That's creepy.
Right.
That's creepy. You know, and I got news for folks. The book I'm writing now, I haven't said one thing, and I'm not going to. I'm not going to say one thing about what I'm researching and writing now.
Right. Okay, well, I just want to mention again, the title is The Third Way, Nazi International, European Union, and Corporate Fascism. They can get it at Giza Death Star, or they can go to any of the usual suspects.
Right. They can. It just literally came out. They can go to Adventures Unlimited Press if they're in a hurry for it. Yeah, buy the book before it's pulled.
No. We're not creating that intention.
No, we're not creating that.
Okay, so you're working on the next book.
Oh, yeah. I started working the moment that book arrived.
Okay. Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about? What's going on the website?
On my website?
Yeah.
Nothing going on. We continue to do our members' vid chats, which are always kind of fascinating, fun discussions and blogs and stuff. I think you and I may have a conference coming up soon. We both are kind of in the...
We hope so.
We hope so, yeah.
Texas in November.
Texas, possibly, yeah.
I know... Before we close, I just wanted to mention one thing we did today is we talked about what in the world is going on. Because I've been very concerned about what's going to happen in the budget cycle in the fall and the extraordinary tensions. Because I think the tensions we're talking about are going to come out in that cycle.
Oh, yes, I do too.
So you and I have been sitting here trying to come up with a hypothesis that would explain the reality we're watching. And it's challenging. Needless to say, I don't know if there's anybody else who spent as much time outside the intelligence agencies trying to figure out what's going on, then you're okay, so it's not like we have dedicated our lives to trying to understand what in the world's going on. Certainly to do what I do, I'm very nervous managing money unless I know what's going on.
Exactly.
So to me, it's a real fiduciary obligation to know what's going on. And I have to say that we don't know.
Yeah, we don't.
We don't.
We don't.
And if we can't figure it out...
It the real problem, and I think you and I have talked about this before, the real problem is all of our models of conventional analysis are not working for what's going on.
Right.
That's why I think you have to factor in these black budget financial items. You have to factor in this hidden system of finance. You have to factor in... let's put it this way, you have to factor in non-state actors
right.
in the equation. The big, let's just call them what they are, the cartels and trusts.
Right.
And particularly the ones in Russia, the ones in China, in Europe. And they're offering some pretty stiff competition to the American financial order. And that's ultimately what I think people have to grasp here. There are hidden players, and until we grapple and come to the realization, we're not talking conspiracy theory here, folks. We're talking conspiracy fact, that these plans were made, these things were done, and we have to therefore take a very long view of our own history and start factoring in some things we don't really like to talk about, and then look to our future and see where it's going to go. And I'm with you. I think that we're looking at the possibility of something that's going to be a coup that may not look like a coup, and it may come from outside this country with people just having been fed up. It's either that or it's the War of League of Cambrai moment for us. And, you know, I don't care how powerful the United States of America is, it cannot take on China and Japan and Russia and Europe. It just can't do it.
Right. It doesn't have the...
It doesn't have the juice.
Okay. Well, from someplace in the heartland, Dr. Joseph Farrell, The Third Way, the Nazi International, European Union, and Corporate Fascism, get it. And the infrastructure web presentation will be up on your site.
Shortly.
As this audio will be on your site as well. So... I can't thank you enough.
Thank you for having me back on.
Okay.